is this man? What sort of devil is he?
Hello guys, this is Ryan Eddie Edmonds and welcome to the second episode of the PPRD cast.
Now, I know a lot of you, what you guys are probably thinking. Mike Mignola can be pretty slow with his workload, getting a few issues out there, but I think I've given him a bit of a run here for his money with this PPRD cast. Last episode was probably about 5 years ago now. Well, that was the last episode ever put out there on the internet. There were a couple more recorded. This is technically PPRD cast episode 2.5. They have unfortunately been lost to the ages now. I would like to thank all those who supported me with the first PPRD cast. Got a lot of lovely feedback. Unfortunately, after those events, I did go through some personal issues at the time, ones I won't get into too much here, because I would like to keep it a bit light and friendly on this episode. But needless to say, and fairly obviously, I did drop off for a while there. And only of recent, through the wonderful support of the comic book noise guru himself, Derek Coward, have I actually been inspired to drop out again and pick up a microphone, set up my computer, and relearn all this audio editing to get you guys another episode and hopefully a lot more here in the future. I want to just give absolute thanks and praise to Derek Coward there for stepping up to the plate. When I said I dropped off the map there, I quite did in a lot of ways, and I never fully had a conversation with Derek that there would be no more episodes for a while, and I sort of disappeared on him there. And despite all that, he still kept the original PPRD cast episode up there on his feed. I have no idea why, but I am very grateful for him for doing that for me. Very, very grateful that he did that for me, and that people could still listen to the episodes. And one of the big things in getting me back was he sent me a comment recently showing me that there were still some impressive numbers on the downloads, despite there only being one episode for all these years. So he's hoping with a few more we can get a few more listeners and reward those that have been downloading that one episode all this time. Hopefully it's not one person just downloading it month after month, because you can always just keep it on your iTunes feed there and listen to it again. No need to keep downloading. Probably shouldn't say that. Derek probably likes the numbers of the downloads coming in, but there's a little behind-the-scenes information for you there. So very grateful there. Probably should admit to those of you who know the Comic Geek Speak presents Murd's Time Bubble host, Adam Murdo. Anytime I have contact with him, I do give him a lot of crap about getting more episodes out there. So truth be revealed, if he ever listens to this, I am far worse than he has ever been. I'd also like to send an apology out to anyone who listened to the very first episode. A lot of people probably didn't pick up on it, but getting ready to do this again, I just re-listened to it. And I got to say, I'm pretty good. I am very, very good. I am also very narcissistic, so no surprise that I was quite pleased with what I listened to there. But no, actually, in all honesty, coming to it 5 years later, I was expecting it to be very cringeworthy, and it wasn't as bad as what I thought. My 22-year-old self was not as dumb as I sort of look back on him being. But there was one bit that I did really cringe, and that was in talking about frog myths. I did catch myself saying in that original audio recording, Aboriginal myth. And in my travels since then, I've learned that probably isn't the most appropriate way of saying it. It's nothing super offensive, but if I was to repeat that section now, I would talk about it being an Indigenous Dreamtime story. The story itself is actually of Tidlick the Frog of the Kulin Nation here in Australia. At the time, I was a bit more ignorant about Indigenous culture here, and it's become a larger part of my life here currently. So it is one section that I do cringe at a bit. I probably won't go back and change the audio there, one, because it would probably be a hassle there for Derek, and I've probably given him enough hassle these last couple of years, just disappearing. The other being, I do tend to like to keep things in their original state. I'm not like George Lucas in that way. But I will put out an apology here now. So if anyone does listen to it and they come here to this next episode, they can see that I have grown up a bit in the short time between episode one and two. And if they have no idea about the gap, then they're going to be very impressed, but they also wouldn't have listened to this first part of the episode. And hear my apology there. Okay, so moving on. Originally, when I recorded this second episode 5 years ago, I do remember it quite clearly. I did it on the Ectoplasm Man, the Johann Kraust one-shot. But since it's been 5 years since the very first episode, I figured I should continue on with a main Hellboy story. Okay, so for this episode, we are going to jump into Hellboy Seeds of Destruction, issue 2. To begin with, the cover itself is of Hellboy wrapped around a Cthulhu-esque monster that we're not quite aware of storyline-wise what is in here. Also, down in the bottom corner, you have a little circle. I didn't talk about this on the first episode itself, but Monkey Man and O'Brien was also running as a backup feature in these comics, which I might have chosen to go into these stories as well when I review these issues, but my original copies of them are framed up on my wall. I'm staring at them right now, and as I said in the first episode, I love you listeners, but you don't mean enough for me to break open that frame and rip it down again. So I'm actually going off the wonderful Dark Horse trades here itself. And speaking of Dark Horse, they do have the Dark Horse logo on them. It's always been published by Dark Horse. But they've also got the Easter Island Head Legendary Comics imprint up the top, which I always find fascinating, but those heads have always been weird for me. Moving into the actual issue itself, it opens with a lovely shot of the Cavendish Hall there, and the main reason for this shot is clearly to establish the water around it. They go into detail in the narration boxes that is water that this hall has been built on, and the hall itself is actually sinking into the lake as time goes by. And I promise, this last time I mentioned the first episode, if you also notice, in these 5 years I have learned the difference between calling them thought squares. I now know they're narration boxes. That was one of the other things I cringed at. Following through, we actually get our first introduction of two major Hellboy characters, if not the two biggest after Hellboy himself. Liz Sherman, presented there in all her glory. She is one of my absolute favourite female characters in comic books, and one of the reasons I love the Hellboy universe itself. And then we got a somewhat introduction of Abe Sapien, looking a little bit different to how we know him. He's a man there in a fedora, blue glasses, and a brown beard. Not exactly the iconic look of Abe Sapien as we have come to know him in today's day and age. And in one of the narration boxes, we also get Hellboy reintroducing himself, just in case you didn't pick up the first issue. Talks about how he's called Hellboy. If he had a real name, he doesn't know what it is. We, of course, as modern-day readers, know that they do eventually go on to reveal that name, but it is a little bit of foreshadowing to the fact that potentially he does have another name out there, and the origins of names plays a little bit into this issue itself, as we'll get to later. Now, then we're introduced to Emma Cavendish, who, in more detail, we did see her in the last issue with a little froggy in her cup of tea there. And she goes through the Cavendish history here for us. One of the big prominent parts setup here is what I'd hope to think is Mike Mignola, possibly John Byrne, doing a little bit of a mise-en-scene with the whaling ship history to the Cavendish family and the paintings in the background. If you look at the painting of the whalers there, it's not exactly your general whaling day there out on the boat. Whaling was a horrible life, but was generally not whales crashing through dinghies while sailors were trying to struggle for their lives and fight the gigantic beast. The image itself is a quite famous one in terms of whaling. It comes from the novel Moby Dick. Now, Moby Dick, for those of you who don't know the story, which is a shame, but I'll help you out anyway, is the story of a man hunting his great white whale. It is a story about obsession and the insanity it can drive men into in a lot of ways that explains the Cavendish family themselves and their search to head up north looking for something greater, which of course leads to their current predicament. And of course there is a lot of imagery with whaling and Moby Dick of the harpoon stabbing through the beast, which is something I'll leave on the table for now, and we will hopefully get to discussing in another podcast down the road there, probably in another 5 to 10 years. We also see in this scene the butler turning up. Now, the butler, we will go on to show, is one of the henchmen of Rasputin, one of those things I love most in the world, these were-frogs. It's also start of something that does happen quite a bit in the Hellboy stories, where we get sort of an innocent or a nondescript character here in the background who does go on to transform into some sort of beast or creature and play a much larger role. And speaking of Rasputin himself, he does come in as our main protagonist leave to settle down for the night. He comes to speak to Emma and talks about him returning his part of the bargain here, which is returning her children, and very creepily tells them to kiss her goodnight. So as it will go on to be revealed, this is the end for Emma. She's meeting a fate rather like Trevor Bartholomew or Professor Broom in the first issue, going to be covered in those weird little nipple-like markings around her body as it goes numb, being killed off by her kids itself. Now, in Hellboy stories by Mike Mignola, Hellboy himself often ends up beating in on killing the monsters, but every now and then you get an almost Tolkien-esque version of evil. For those of you who have read the works of J.R.R. Tolkien, a lot of the evil characters in that end up, or those who are not even so much evil, but those who choose the darker path, end up being the dealers of their own fates. And this is kind of what happens to Emma here itself. It's not any of our protagonists doing anything that leads to her death. It's the choices that she has made here brings about her end. And I quite like that portrayal of evil itself. Moving through to the next scene, we get a little bit of talk about Liz Sherman and her origin. Shows that she, when she was an 11-year-old girl, she was revealed to be a pyrotechnic by burning down 2 city blocks, killing 32 people, some of which were actually her mother, her father, and brothers. This, to me, now, I love Liz Sherman, I do. I was saying before, I really do love the character. The origin here, though not bad, is it's a little bit on the X-Men side for me, sort of that going into pubescent age, tragic events, the reveal of the powers, family members lost, creating a bit of angst thrown in there itself. I do like the idea of potentially the woman of the team being the most powerful because of an inner strength. And I've known quite a few women in my life who have that burning fire in them that, you know, at some point in between being a girl and becoming a woman,
they do need to control in their life, and I do quite like that imagery. But, yeah, the origin story, while it works and is efficient for the story, can be told in one page and move on. In looking at the depth that Liz has grown to become as a character, I would wonder if it's the origin story that Mike Mignola would potentially go with today. Now, the next scene we cut across to one of the great things in Hellboy stories, which is Abe and Red having a bit of R&R talk, and these scenes are always great. They're actually very few and far between in the comic books. We got some absolutely fabulous ones in the Guillermo del Toro movies, but usually Mike Mignola is very economic with his comic book timing, and these scenes do rarely appear, but they're always fantastic when they're here. Now, this is something I'm going to put out to you listeners out there, if you can correct me. In this scene, Hellboy talks about himself not always being right. Something we did see in the first issue there, when he just jumped into a black room. And he comments to Abe that he hopes that it's nothing like China in 1979. Now, often with Mike Mignola, when he drops these little hints here in the early issues, he did go on to flesh out a lot of these stories later on. Now, this is one I have not been able to find anywhere itself. Maybe I'm not looking hard enough. Maybe I've missed it. Maybe it's not in one of the comics. It's in one of the novels that I've got piled up there that I still need to get through. As far as I know, the Christopher Golden novels are the only ones in continuity themselves, and I have read those ones. No China in any of them. There's a little bit of China later on in the BPRD series, mainly around the Garden of Souls time, but nothing overly to do with Hellboy and Abe there. Maybe it's referenced more in a conversation elsewhere that I've missed somewhere. But if you know what it is, feel free to get into contact and help me fill in that detail there. And coming up, we also then get into a bit more of an origin of Abe himself, as well as a proper full reveal. He drops the beard and the hat, revealing himself to be a fish man, which is absolutely brilliant. Abe is, of course, one of the fan favorite characters in the Hellboy universe, and it is very clear to see why he is even more fish-like than Aquaman himself. And he carries himself in a just very ordinary way. There's a lot of comedy here with Abe, without him actually saying any jokes at all. But a lot of seriousness in his pose and his look and his very dynamic-looking character. And although I was just ratting on Liz Sherman's origin here in the universe, Abe's is one of, if not my favourite origin story in the world of comic books, if not literature in general. He was found in the basement of St. Trinian's Hospital in Washington with the note listed on it, Ichthoi Sapien, April 14th, 1865. Now, if you said to me, April 14th, 1865, I would probably look at you little bit funny. If you ask me sort of what was going on, history that day maybe is a little clue. I would probably talk about the Ballarat Bendigo Gold Rush, which was a big event in history here in Australia, which I am from, hence the sexy accent that you're hearing in your headphones right now. But in terms of growing up here in Australia, I wouldn't know that was the date that Honest Abe, Abraham Lincoln, the president at the time in the United States, was murdered there by John Wilkes Booth in the theater. I'm actually surprising myself in how much I do know about Abraham Lincoln here. I'm yet to see the Spielberg film, but I imagine it's pretty close to what I just said there. I was going to try and name what number president he was, but I couldn't tell you that. But if you're disappointed in my knowledge there, try and tell me who the prime minister was here in Australia at the time, and we can compare notes on how good history class is on either side. Now, of course, we do go on to learn a little bit more about Ape Sapien's origin, a little bit to my disappointment. The origin story is fine there and definitely, once again, services the plot and what it needs to do, and you couldn't have a comic book universe travelling along for so long with threads hanging like this without parts of it being revealed. But to me, this origin always works best when nothing's actually revealed at all, and it is just the big mystery there for the ages. So Abe dives off out the window into the lake below. One of the great character-building dialogues is that Hellboy mentions in his narration box that Abe does not make a sound as he hits the water, showing that not only is he a fishman, but he is quite at home with the waterways itself. Starts talking to Liz over one of the brilliant little walkie-talkies that look very much like the ones that came with the Mezco comic book action figures, just minus the zinc written there on the speaker. Liz drops mention to there being frogs in the room, and Hellboy goes into that very cliche horror film of get out, over the phone. Once again, love Liz. This part here is not exactly my favourite shining moment for her. I'm sure at some point Hellboy probably mentioned what happened to Professor Broom. Her and Liz had a bit of a relationship there itself, so I would imagine that his death would have sprung some questions for her and how it came about, and for being one of the best paranormal investigators, she doesn't seem clued in to the fact that there might be a connection here between these frogs and the frogs that happened to take out Broom there itself. So a bit disappointed on her intelligence level as it's portrayed here. And also because this means she gets kidnapped and will become the damsel in distress in this storyline, Seeds of Destruction, as it goes forward. Now, obviously we get a lot better Liz Sherman stories later coming up. That do make her a fantastic character, and she is in no way the typical damsel in distress as portrayed in a lot of films and media, but not exactly my shining favourite moment for Liz Sherman here itself. But to Liz Sherman fans, don't worry, I'm with you, I'm a big Liz Sherman fan. Got her action figure, love it, but I think they have gone on to do better things with her than her first appearance here. And then, of course, Hellboy busting into the room. Butler guy, as we were talking about before, gets revealed to be a werefrog. One of my favourite things. This is why I love comics, people. Because we get werefrogs, which are just not as commonplace on the news programs or reality TV shows of today. And, of course, when there's a werefrog, it means we get some lovely, beautiful panels of Mike Mignola artwork with Hellboy Smash. Lovely fight scene here. The final end of it, when Hellboy is standing over the broken and defeated body of this werefrog, is just one of my favourite pieces of Hellboy art. Just his positioning, the tail loop there. And I love, though he's typically portrayed with yellow eyes, the red eyes here showing his anger. Once again, Mike Mignola very rarely gets into the pupils. He just goes generally with straight eye colouring, and this red here is really effective in showing the rage in Hellboy's face and what he's capable with when you mess with his family. At the same time, we also have Abe exploring the caverns and catacombs in the waterways there. And sort of subtly, if you look, there's a few not-so-nice body parts floating around in the water with him, such as a skull, leading to some very, very nasty ambience there on what he is about to discover, which we won't learn until the next issue itself. It moves back in the next scene. We have Hellboy coming face to face, the very Empire Strikes Back moment where he meets his father and creator and is warned of ominous things to come and asked to join him as he moves forward there.
As it comes about, the Cthulhu tentacle creature of the cover burst forth out of the ground, dragging him deep into the pit. And the final shot of the page is a fantastic piece of art of the right hand of Doom, Hellboy's stony arm, reaching out, wrapped in tentacles, and a few planks of wood higher up as he's falling deep into this dark void, where we as the reader are quite not quite too sure what's going on. I should mention in this issue itself, we do start to get some dialogue more so about his hand, building up as a larger tool of what's going to be very important in the Hellboy stories here to come. So this is, as I was talking about in this issue, there are some things that bug me. Liz's ignorance, her origin, it's... To be honest, the history of the Cavendish one takes up quite a few pages, and I do get a little bit bored each time I read that. I think that could have been cut down a little bit there. Maybe he's got more plans to delve into that in the future, and it will all become worthwhile. But I do find those first couple of pages of dialogue there a little rough, and I do find the dropping of the hand a little too dropped in for this issue. But on the whole, this is an extremely important issue for Hellboy itself. It's one of the first times we actually see him out and about investigating. It's one of the first times we really get that Hellboy entering a manor slash castle investigation type. We get our first sort of creepy man there who obviously evolves into a creature. We have the meeting of Hellboy and Rasputin. We have the introduction of both Abe and Liz, two very major characters. So very important, definite must read. I don't think there'll be a Hellboy issue that I ever say. Well, if you like Hellboy, you should definitely read this issue. It's pretty much going to be every issue, but this one itself, when you look back at the importance that it has in the mythos, it's definitely a major one. A lot of iconic shots here when you think of Hellboy. You've got to think of that fight with the werefrog and the origin shot of Abe sitting there in that tank under St. Trinian's itself. So I've probably come in a little bit shorter of time than I did with the last episode. I've still been talking here for quite a bit. Probably a little bit more rustier than what I was with that first episode there, both in my recording skills and just with my Hellboy knowledge in general. But I do want to just say a big thank you once again to everyone out there who kept the PPRD podcast alive, despite there only being one episode and despite the actual guy behind the scenes here running, sort of walking away from the ship for a while. I am back here now. I do hope to get more of these episodes out to you in a more timely manner. Once again, just I cannot lump enough praise onto Derek Howard there over there at Comic Book Noise. If you are listening to this podcast, it means somehow I have managed to get it out there. Most likely, Derek has always said I have a home there on the reader feed. So I'm assuming here at this recording point that this is where the episode will pop up and appear over there at the Comic Book Noise reader feed. If you are listening to this for the very first time, welcome. The original episode is no longer on iTunes from what I could see, but it is at the Comic Book Noise website. Probably worth a look, popping in, checking out. Obviously some time differences there. I don't really want to go back along and redo what I did in that first episode. Listening to it again the other day, I actually am quite proud of what's done there. And as I was talking about before, I'm not a big fan of redoing things. I like to leave them archived for what they were at the time and what they are here and now. But with that, I'm going to leave you there, and hopefully I will see you then before another 5 years. So this is Ryan Eddie Edmonds signing off for another episode of PPRD Cast. Say hello to your mum for me and thank her for the rabbits.